Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
You know, we're doing Hemingway's, right? Big two-hearted river. There we go. It's a fishing story. And I tell him some cool things about Hemingway. I tell him about World War I and emotional trauma and healing through fishing. And I can see sometimes a little flicker there. The light's going on. And that's just my job. And I try to reach them, but it's work. Sometimes it's work. And you do feel exhausted after the class. Not in a bad way. It's like after a good workout, like a good run.
That was Henry Hughes describing how he connects to his college students through fly fishing. This is the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Did you know that you can read the entire transcript for this episode? Another service we offer, if you click the link in the show notes at the top there and head over to the website, or you can just head over to wetflyswing.com/231. And if you want, it's a pretty cool way to search. And if you missed anything along the way, it's got the whole transcript right there. Henry Hughes, deputy editor of the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, shares some of the great books that he loves on fly fishing. We hear about his connection to Nick Lyons and Thomas McGuane and some of the upcoming pieces he has coming up in Gray's Journal and some other journals around the country. If you need some new material of the literary variety, this is the show for you. So without further ado, here is Henry Hughes. How's it going, Henry?
Good morning. It's going great, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for putting this one together, another early one. I like to get started early before a lot of times before my girls get up because they're once they get up, they're fired up. So I appreciate you getting started early here.
We're fishermen. We got to get up early.
Yeah, that's right. Is that your style? Are you good? Are you more get up early or rest a little bit?
Oh, I'm definitely a morning person. Absolutely. Good. Whether it's fishing or writing, thinking. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. Awesome. Do you do your... that's a good question on the right. I think of, I've been putting together a presentation actually for the Art Flick, Trout Unlimited chapter. It's just kind of a general thing. The person running that reached out to me cause he listens to the show.
Great.
And I've been going back through my back catalog, trying to put together some of my best episodes and the John Gearock episode keeps flashing back to me because I remember when I did it. It was kind of like, whoa, okay, I got to make sure not to screw this one up. but he came through with some really great stuff. And one of them was he was talking about my my guests and how that's my currency, right? Like you right now, if I don't bring on good guests to the show and do a good job, that's like, that's kind of all I have. So, you know, when you hear that, what do you think about as far as, you know, of what you do? And maybe we can dig into what you do a little bit, but does that resonate with you? I mean, how do you, what's your currency?
It does. My students, I guess, you know, that's, I am employed as a professor. And so my first, you know, line of intensity is that I do a good job as a teacher. And so I guess that's my currency, but, I love what you said. I mean, you're very humble. Your show is wonderful. And, you know, connecting with people is one of the most important things about, I think, an angling world. Everyone loves to fish alone, mostly.
Right.
It's very solitary, right? Very meditative, sometimes enterprise. We hate when there are other anglers, you know, getting in close to us. But fishing increases our sense of the world through conversations like this one, Dave, and through writing. And I love teaching. And I talk to my students about fishing. I actually teach a course, you know, about the literature of angling and all this networking and communication and books. And so it's interesting kind of paradox to the angling world, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's. I think you're totally right. Yeah, you start off. Well, I mean, I think sometimes people have friends or family they go fishing with, but you're right. When you get on the water, the solitary, the meditative piece is what I think a lot of people love, getting away from the city and the cell phones and social media.
Exactly.
Well, this is good. I mean, this is really interesting. I mean, I think I've interviewed a few people. We talked about a little bit of Nick Lyons, who was, you know, another one of those interviews where I was a little, you know, a little scared getting into, but I think that's a good thing. And it turned out great. And you have a similar history. I mean, talk about that because you know Nick. How similar is what you do in your background or your history? You know, I know you're younger, obviously, but to what Nick has done.
Well, Nick is, you know, a king. I mean, yeah. he's had a brilliant, illustrious career in publishing, writing, you know, fishing. It's interesting. I corresponded with Nick for many years. We met for the first time a couple years ago at his apartment in New York. We had the most extraordinary conversation. And I'm sure you found this too. He's such a gentle, kind, you know, unpretentious man. So it immediately invites conversation. And we do have a lot in common. You know, Nick was also a professor of English and decided that was going to be his passion. I love that idea that you have to find out what your fire is, right? Like his new memoir, Fire in the Straw. You have to know what really you love in life. And early on, I realized I loved language. I loved reading and writing and talking. And they're probably more lucrative, you know, enterprises to go into. You know, my family would say, oh, be a lawyer. You know, that's what English majors do. You'll make a lot of money.
All right.
I didn't want to be a lawyer, just like Nick didn't want to be a businessman.
No.
So, yeah, I always followed that route. And then fishing ran parallel to everything I did from a very young age. I loved to fish. I grew up on Long Island, New York, like Nick. I'm an East Coaster. And it was a very fishy town, a little town on the north shore of Long Island called Port Jefferson. And my father did not like to fish. He had no interest, but he was a good dad, you know, so he would take me and there was a friend who knew something about fishing. And we started out, of course, just like Nick, bait fishing, you know, in the harbor, catching flounder and, you know, and porgies and things like that. And then eventually developing into more of a sport angler. And fly fishing, you know, for the first time, really, for bluefish, which are wonderful fish to encourage you as a fly angler, because they'll take anything and they fight, you know, wonderfully. And so that was very exciting for me as a young person catching a bluefish in Long Island Sound.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I'm glad you started there, brought us back to your start, because I think, I mean, since then, and you've done some traveling around the world, right? I mean, have you, maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I know your book that you're, I guess, re-releasing or is coming out again. Talk about that book first and then talk about your world travels.
Yeah, sure thing. Yeah, Backseat with Fish is a memoir that I wrote in 2016. It's coming out this summer in paperback. Nick Lyons, you know, helped kind of acquire that book for Skyhorse Publishing. And it does describe my life. We all have interesting lives, I think, right? It's just, you know, how do you write it? How do you talk about it? And so I love Long Island where I grew up, but I was eager to move. And so I went to school in the Midwest. I lived in South Dakota and Indiana and fished in those rivers and ponds and lakes. And then I went to Japan. I did a master's in English at Purdue in Indiana and went to Japan for 3 years, fished extensively. Japanese, you know, love to fish, obviously, great angling culture, immersed in the magic of the Pacific. And then I lived in China for 2 years. I was teaching English, also fishing. I mean, in Backseat with Fish, I described kind of sneaking in, bribing some guards, my girlfriend and I, in one of these, imagine one of these like big palatial Chinese parks, you know, with ornamental koi and all these big carp, and we're, you know, casting dry flies and catching these giant carp and, you know, fighting them around like pagodas and stuff. It was crazy fun. I love to travel, always take my fishing gear. And now I'm back in Oregon. I eventually took a job here in Western Oregon. And of course, great fishing of the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm.
That's right. How'd you land on Western? Because I you know, I know obviously I'm in Oregon as well, and Western, I didn't realize, I guess it is a big, I always thought of as a teacher school, right? A place where teachers go and learn to become teachers. But yeah, how'd you land on Western?
Yeah, it's a great teaching school. My wife is in the College of Education, and it has a great reputation for that. Well, you know, when you finish, I did a PhD in American literature. I went back to school after China. And when you have a degree that's kind of specialized as an academic, you know, you can't just go anywhere. You have to go on a job market, and certain jobs open. And a job opened here at Western Oregon. It's a you know, modest state school, about 5,000 mm-hmm. students. And I was delighted. I said, yeah, I mean, Oregon, it's got great fishing. I didn't even know what the salary was. I said, okay, I'm coming, you know.
Nice. Where'd you come from before this job?
Yeah, I just finished. I went back to Purdue in Indiana to finish my PhD. And of course, Long Island was always home. So I had gone home that summer. And I mean, I was a poor grad student. I had a beat up 20-year-old Buick that my father helped me patch back together. And I drove that crazy rig from New York to Oregon. Again, fishing along the way, believe it or not, you know, getting a one-day license to fish in Montana and come down through Washington. And so it was always part of my journey. And I do describe that in Backseat with Fish.
Oh, good. I'll put a link in the show notes to that and anything else we talk about here today. So, yeah, I was kind of curious, you know, just thinking about writers. We're going to maybe focus a little bit on, you know, not only yourself, but other writers. And I was just looking at, you know, when you think of the best fly fishing writers, you know, there's things you could Google up and see what pops up. But, you know, some of the names, and I've had some of them on the show. Like I mentioned Gear Rock, Tom Rosenbauer, you know, Norman McLean, McGuane. I mean, there's all these, right? Who, when you think of some of the great fly fishing writers out there, is there a list that comes like a top 10 list or something in your mind, or what comes to your mind there?
Yeah, well, certainly those writers are on my list. You know, there are different kinds of writers. And you mentioned Tom McGuane. I know Nick Lyons is a fan. And Nick talked about Tom McGuane and Ted Leeson. And those are two very special writers in my life, because they look at the other dimensions of fishing. Sure, there's adventure and there's natural history and there's great knowledge of fly fishing, technical knowledge, but there's also a kind of artistic, cultural, you know, sensibility that takes it to another level. And I really like that. Like McGuane can do that in an essay. It's profound. Without being kind of overly self-conscious. You know, fly fishing can go there, Dave. Some of the writing can go really precious, really yeah. quick. You know what I'm talking yeah. about? Like, oh, it's the perfect stream, the perfect morning, the perfect hatch.
Right.
I hold this jeweled trout. I mean, we can almost can, you know, create this list of cliches.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's not true to experiences. I've also, right, and you have, we've been very mm-hmm. high out there and thought, oh, my God, it's magical. And that's all very real. But then how in writing do you render that in a kind of fresh, original way, you know, to make it vivid
yeah.
and not just like the same old kind of trout poem. And so people exactly. like McGuane can do that. You know, there's new writers. I want to mention Noah yeah. Davis. Noah Davis is a young emerging writer. I've been seeing his work in all the good magazines, the Drake and Fly Fish Journal and Angler's Journal. And so he just did an MFA at Indiana University, and he's just writing really well. And there's new issues to deal with, you know, issues about conservation and global mm-hmm. warming, and even issues like gender. You know, I like to see more women fishing. You know, I read some great poems by Nora Esty, and, you know, just a woman who's writing about fly fishing. You know, you don't see as many women writing. There are some great ones, of course. Annie Prue is one of my favorite writers, famous for Brokeback Mountain, but you know, oh, yeah. She knows fly fishing, and she's written some brilliant stories, fly fishing stories. Some of them even kind of gothic and creepy. Right. The Were Trout is one that comes to mind. So there's a lot of good literature out there.
Well, you mentioned poems, and I know you are also the deputy editor of Fly Fishing Tying Journal, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. And I've talked to Craig. Craig's been on here as well, and that's always a lot of fun. I'm just curious on the poetry, because you've written, and that's been a big topic for you. Is that something, I mean, what has been your focus with FTJ over the years? I'm not sure, as deputy editor, what have you been in charge of?
Yeah, you're right. It's connected to poetry. You know, Frank Amato and Craig Schumann were wonderful in kind of bringing me aboard and letting me do a kind of a literary component to the magazine. And I said to them, I said, well, Gray's Sporting Journal always runs a poem. I've always admired Gray's. What a beautiful magazine. And so, you know, why don't we run some poems? And the danger is there's a lot of, you know, crappy poetry out there, you know. I mean, you know, cowboy poetry, that has its place. But I'm like, no, I'd like a literary poem, you know, accessible for our readership, you know. It's not the New Yorker, but just good poems about fly fishing. And so they let me select two poems for every issue, and we're quarterly. So I mentioned Noah Davis. He's had poems in there. Nora Esty. We've had, you know, Cameron Scott. We have some terrific poets. And so I enjoy selecting poems for the magazine. And I like to write poetry as well, about fly fishing, all kinds of fishing. And same kind of considerations play in. You don't want to just go to the cliche. You want to avoid the old hackneyed ways of describing a magical moment. You kind of have to find fresh language. I really believe poetry, you know, needs to do that constantly, find the right words to say, you know, what you're feeling and what you're experiencing. But yeah, it's good to see fishing poetry out there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's, I mean, I think that is something, you know, I'm talking to you, obviously you're a PhD educated and you're in the space and stuff, but for somebody who maybe is new to it and they don't know a lot about poetry, I mean, you know, where would somebody get started if they're kind of listening now? They're thinking, well, this might be interesting to find some new work. I mean, I guess FTJ, you have some stuff there, but where would you send somebody to learn more about, you know, where fly fishing poetry is and a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And there are some anthologies. In fact, I put one together for Knopf Random House called The Art of Angling, Poems About Fishing. Hmm. That's available in any bookstore, Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I collected, you know, lots of poems from all kinds of fishing, but lots of fly fishing poems from, you know, ancient China to from ancient China to the present. And so looking at anthologies that have collected poetry about fishing is a good place to start. Gray's publishes a poem in every issue, hunting or fishing. Mm-hmm. A lot of fly fishing poems. You can look at that magazine. Angler's Journal is a magazine I really admire. It covers all kinds of fishing, beautifully produced, gorgeous photography. Again, not how-to stuff. That's really fading away from a lot of magazine publishing. It's more about the culture, the art of fishing. And they run poems as well. I've had some poems in there. But because people don't really know what poetry is. They think it's just rhyming verse. And again, that's certainly a kind of poetry, and that's appropriate for certain occasions. But I kind of, you know, strive toward a more literary poem that's just kind of trying to say something a little bit deeper about the experience. And it's just a matter of, reading other poems and pick up FTJ and look at some of the poems we've published. Send me an email. And I'll point you to some good fishing poetry.
Perfect. Yeah, we had you mentioned Angler's Journal. I had Gary Reich on, and we did a Lefty Cray episode where we talked about Lefty, and so I dug into a little bit of Angler of that journal. It seems like, you know, with the magazine, I mean, we've talked a little bit about this on the air, but, you know, how magazines are changing. Obviously, I remember when I talked to Craig a while back about it, because I know FTJ was always a lot of tips and tricks and stuff like that, you know, which is, you know, and this podcast is too as well. I mean, there's a lot of tips and tricks we dig into here today. We might not touch on a lot of that because I like to keep it open. But, you know, obviously the stories, you know, stories are kind of the king in part that I always try to bring out. But when you're looking at FTJ, how do you find, you know, say you have somebody you want to bring on, or, you know, how do you find people to write? I mean, obviously you have a lot of authors out there. How do you know, or are you guys just getting submissions and you have too many to read through?
We get a lot of submissions, and Craig handles the technical articles, the kind of travel pieces or the location pieces. And I acquire the poems, often the tail out, which is our kind of thoughtful, you know, think piece at the end of the magazine, the tail out. And then, you know, sometimes just essays about a kind of fishery or perhaps the history of a fly. I enjoy the history of fly fishing. Even a short story. We do publish short stories. We have a contest. Paul Schilleri, one of the towering figures in the history of fly fishing, a great historian. He's got a short story in our current issue. But so I go for that stuff too. I do solicit manuscripts from writers that I know. I'll ask them if they have something. We do get submissions. And, you know, it's a really interesting question because how much technical how-to, you know, step-by-step fly tying do you offer in a magazine? You know, FTJ is a little bit of a more traditional magazine in that way. We still do that, and we still have a number of perhaps even older subscribers and readers that want that. And you know very well, Dave, the new generation, it's YouTube, you know, it's looking up something on the web. That's how you learn how to tie a new fly. There's endless videos. And so kind of straddling those two technologies or those two traditions is key. Now, again, FTJ, we're trying to do that to be faithful to our readership. But the new magazine, you know, is, as you know, Fly Fish Journal, a beautiful magazine like that, or Drake. They're all about the culture mostly and the place and the conservation. And so you don't see a lot of technical stuff. It's mentioned, you know, it's discussed, but it's not the focus of the article.
That's right. No, I think it's it's just an interesting time to be, because especially as, you know, and myself as a podcaster, right? This is a kind of a fairly new medium, you know, that's kind of come in, and you know, it's been skyrocketing recently because I think people, it's becoming more mainstream. And but I try to balance it. Like I said, I try to do a little bit of both where I can, and kind of hear the background of my guests. But yeah. So I guess, yeah, I mean, sticking on that with you, you know, again, I'm kind of interested in the teaching a little bit. You know, I mean, maybe talk about what you do at Western, and sure, talk about how that is connected to the fly fishing and the other writing you do.
Yeah, so I teach a variety of courses, but I teach surveys and literature. So if you want to, you know, American literature, I do all the greatest hits. And then I'll do maybe a course on the short story, or I do special seminars, literature of the sea. And we might do Moby Dick and a number of contemporary pieces about, you know, maritime adventure. I'll do a special course on fly fishing. You know, I'll just pick a bunch of works, famous works. You've mentioned some of them. We might spend, you know, a couple weeks on Norman MacLean's The River Runs Through It and do a detailed analysis of that. There's plenty of literature in the fly fishing world to support a course. Now, you can't run that course all the time, but you can run it off and on. And so I teach writing, too. I actually teach the craft of writing, poetry, fiction, essay. And, you know, it's almost like a little bit of, they tease me a little bit, my colleagues and students. Well, if he can get fishing in there somehow, he will, you know. And so they know me. Like, well, there's a lot of fishing stories in this course packet, or, you know, and students even write about fishing, probably because they know I love it. And so I have to keep it under control. But I am fortunate, like Nick Lyons and others, where my career as a teacher and a writer nicely dovetailed with my love of fishing. I don't know how many sports that would work for. You know, there's just so much literature and culture connected to fly fishing. It has an air of respectability. You know, I don't know if I could pull off if it were baseball. Maybe baseball, but I don't. Bowling? I don't know. It'd be tough with bowling.
Right. No. Yeah, probably not.
So, I mean, we all do that. We try to parlay our passions. And I think what you're doing, like with the podcast and your own fishing and guiding the family, you got to try to make everything kind of work together. You can't have opposing forces in your life. I find that slows me down. So, I just teach courses, and sometimes they have nothing to do with fishing, but believe it or not, yeah, I can manage something about nature. I've taught a course on rivers, for example, and just to pick a bunch of great works of literature about rivers, you know, whether it's Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi or Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, or, you know, poems about fishing. You know, I mean, you can get all kinds of stuff in there. That's fun. I think the students really appreciate the variety of that too.
When you talked about, go back to that fly fishing segment you did, or the class, I mean, who were your students on average? What was that person in the audience? What were they going to become?
Yeah, they're about, let's say we had about 15 students, about 10 were women, most English majors, or a lot of our students interested in humanities are female. And so that's kind of challenging sometimes because they may not have as much experience in fishing, but so I kind of have to talk more maybe generally about fishing. But they are a variety of majors, and sometimes it's a business major who just had an interest in fishing. One to take an elective, one to take one course in writing or literature, but a lot of English majors, and you know, it's funny because sometimes someone will just come and say, you know, I fished once when I was a kid with my dad and I really liked it. And I haven't fished in 10 years. And I just thought, you know, this would be a cool class. And it's really interesting. I hear those stories a lot from people that they've fished once or twice and had a powerful experience, but haven't done it in a long time. And there's a kind of nostalgia connected to that, a kind of reclaiming youth and innocence and beauty. And a lot of the times the literature really spoke to those people. And I heard back from several that they went fishing again. So I'm delighted, you know, that they kind of found fishing. They were re-excited by fishing through the literature and are now, you know, contacting an uncle or a friend and going back to that lake that they haven't been to in so long.
Exactly. Kind of, yeah, they're planting the seed. Or, you know, the seed was planted as a kid. And then you're kind of there coming up when they're still young, you know, adults, and you're keeping that going. I mean, do you feel like you've had a good contribution in getting people into, you know, fly fishing over the years?
Yes. Yes, I do. And it's not hard to do. And when, if the weather is good, we've actually taken the class out to the Willamette River, which is just down the road in Independence. And I take out some fly rods and, you know, can't do any harm. It's a nice gravel beach. Back cast is pretty easy. And give a quick lesson and let them cast too. And I remember this one young woman, she was just so enthralled and she really picked it up quickly. She started casting beautifully. And she just said to me, she goes, "This feels so good." And you know that feeling, right? When it's just, yeah, when, you know, you're loading line nicely and it's just lying out a good cast. And I was like, yeah, it does feel good. And yeah, so that was kind of a magical moment. And I'm sure, you know, as a guide, you experience that all the time. But as a, you know, teacher in the classroom, I don't. And so that was pretty exciting too.
Well, I wanted to kind of go back again, you know, to that books we mentioned. I'm trying to think of a list of books again for somebody. And are you more, when you think about the stuff you read, I mean, obviously I'm sure you've read kind of everything, but do you enjoy more kind of some of the books or more magazines or more poetry? What's your focus right now?
Yeah, good question. Well, I do read the magazines because I like to contribute to them. And so again, not to overly plug Angler's Journal, but I like what they're doing. You know, like I said, you had Gary Reich on and Bill Sisson is their chief editor, really wonderful man. But the depth of culture, I like reading about interesting people like Lefty Cray, right? What a legend. And so biographies or a kind of, you know, detailed kind of discussion of a place and the characters involved. I love crazy characters in the fishing world. I contributed a piece recently to Angler's Journal about a woman who fillets, the fillet queen.
Oh yeah. God. Yeah. Saw that.
You know, she's great. I mean, and so just like those personalities. So I liked reading the magazines. And again, in terms of writers, boy, you know, there's so many, and there are also books that, you know, maybe have been forgotten. I mentioned women again, Margot Page's wonderful book, Little Rivers, you know, kind of a pun on Little Women. That's a great book about fly fishing that's kind of been neglected. You know, there's an anthology that Holly Morris did a few years ago. I think it's called A Different Angle. And it's women who fly fit, women, you know, writing about fly fishing. And I think that was really a cool book. I know there's an Annie Proulx story in there. You know, a couple other writers that are coming up or Stephen Sautner is a terrific writer. Fish On, Fish Off came out a few years ago. And I really like his work. You'll see him in a lot of the magazines, mostly fly fishing, other kinds of fishing too. Matt Miller, another terrific writer, works for the Nature Conservancy, I believe, and is writing about fly fishing. The British scene is interesting. My wife is British, and so we go to England and Wales almost every year. Charles Rangeley Wilson, I mentioned him to you, Dave. He's a terrific writer. He had a couple articles in The Guardian, you know, Britain's leading paper, like their New York Times in a way. But he's a serious fly fisherman, and I like his work a lot. And he does great urban angling scenes, you know, fishing under bridges in London, you know, trying to seek out the trout, you know, that are just hanging on there in some of the more polluted urban areas, but also getting out into the beautiful countryside, of course, the famous chalk streams of England. So there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of good writers out there.
Yeah, there is. No, this is great. I'm glad you keep you're going on this, because I think it'd be cool to have a list of just, you know, probably, you know, a number of different, you know, writers and authors that people can kind of dig into to get more information. So this is cool. And we mentioned, you know, we mentioned Nick, you know, again, I guess I keep going back to him a little, because you guys do have a similar career, mm-hmm. although, you know, I mean, he was, I guess, his story is interesting, right? The whole, and his kind of goes back to England as well, but, you know, how he became the editor of, you know, Lions Press, right. which was big. And, you know, but again, going back to Nick, I mean, when you compare yourself to Nick, I mean, that's a hard thing to do, I know. But, you know, I mean, do you see, I mean, other than what you've talked about, are there other things that kind of pop out with Nick? I mean, or, you know, I'm kind of getting to that point, like what makes Nick and maybe even some of these other editors and writers that at the top? You know what I mean? Right. Is it just literally they work harder than everybody else, or does like McGuain and Gearock and these other guys, do they have something special?
What is the secret to success?
Yeah. What is their secret? Because I haven't asked. I don't think Gearock told me exactly. Maybe that's a hard question.
Well, I think hard work is huge. I mean, when Nick tells you the things that he did to keep his family afloat and taking night jobs, and he was a mm-hmm. ghostwriter, and you know, he was yeah. a professor and an editor, and
tiring.
Goodness, he yeah. worked so hard.
Are you working that hard? I mean, is that like when you?
No. I love your question. No, I'm not working that hard. I have moments when I think I want to, and I do get into zones where I get a lot done.
But you're not doing 4 hours. You're not doing 4 hours of sleep a night.
No, I like to play too. I really like to play. I like to, you know, take a day off and have a few drinks. I like to goof around in the garden with my wife. We do a little gardening. That's one of our. I like to go fishing. Now, fishing cuts into work time. There's the big one. I love to fish, and fish once a week, sometimes twice a week, and that's typically a morning, but not always. Now I can get out in the evening, but my mornings are my work time. So when I'm really in the zone, let's say I really want to write something. I've got an essay I want to write. Or I'm cleaning up a batch of poems. I'm editing something. Even working for the magazine, I got some work I need to read. What I need to do is I need to exercise and feel good. I need to go to bed at a decent hour. Honestly, don't drink too much. Behave myself. Get up early. Get to the desk feeling fresh and crisp, and work till about 11 o'clock.
What's early? What time do you get up?
Get to the desk at 6 o'clock, 6 a.m.
Yeah. All right.
Even earlier, 5:30, and feeling good, drinking my cup of tea and getting to work. No distractions. I don't even look at my email when I first get to the desk, because I don't want, even if it's good news, I don't want to be distracted. I want to focus on my work and just get something done. Work 3 or 4 hours. Then you take a break, have your lunch, maybe go for a walk, and then other things. I got to teach. I got to deal with students, Zooming, then the business of the day. But if I can keep the morning to myself, and Tom McGuain and I have talked about this, he says the same thing. He says, you know, don't let the world get in. Work on your writing. In fact, you know, McGuain is amazing. He's 81. I just got an email from him yesterday. He caught his largest tarpon last few months, 160 pounds.
Jeez.
Down, I think he was down in the Bahamas
sure.
with Schwinnard hanging sure. out down there.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm like, dude, man, that's my goal.
Yeah.
And he's very disciplined, but yeah, mornings, keep a little bit of the morning to yourself, before the world gets in on you. I mean, sometimes that's impossible, but that's my little kernel of wisdom. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's right. I think you find your time where you get your work done and you get that done first. You know, with your fishing, so take us there for a second. So now you're tucking in, you're getting one of your projects done, but how do you work fishing into the mix? You just save a day?
Right, there. I save a yeah. day, and I feel much better. My conscience feels cleaner when I've gotten a lot of work done. I hate having a little bit of guilt hanging over me, like I got a big thing I got to finish. So it's nice when I work maybe one day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I'm going to take Thursday morning and go fishing. And, you know, just same thing. They'll get up very early. I love to fish in the morning. And you know, but it takes energy, you know, and you got to trailer a boat perhaps and get gear ready. And then there's the cleanup after. I also, you know, we harvest fish. We catch stocked rainbows from some of these lakes in the Cascades or Detroit Lake. And so then I'm cleaning fish and kokanee. We've been catching kokanee lately, so I got to clean some fish. And and so it's a day, you know, it can be a day. But to me, it's worth it. So I balance the fishing and work, and then teaching and family as well. I try to balance it, but I'm not as driven as some of these people like you're describing. Nick Lyons was driven, and it hasn't hurt him. Sometimes it hurts people, and it can damage, I think, your stress levels get too high. People have heart attacks, so they just become kind of bitter. And that's not at all the case with Nick. So there are people who can just do it. And I do admire them too. And I aspire to that. Maybe, you know, well, I'm only 55, so maybe I can get it together, you know, yet and have my best years ahead. I really believe that sometimes.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think you're right in your prime. You know, I mean, 55 seems like that's the you know, I don't know. I think they say mid 40s is when people, or at least males, are at their top of their, kind of making money, right? Part of their, mm-hmm. their life. But 50s seems like you only get better, especially with the right. When you're out fishing, so you're on the, I mean, are you, because that's kind of work too, a little bit, right? Because you're writing about fishing. I mean, do you find yourself kind of thinking about work or an article that's connected to your fishing when you're out there?
Yeah, I get ideas. And sometimes I take notes, like even just on my phone or something, make a little audio note, but mostly I just do it. And then when I come home, I keep a fishing log. So I write a very detailed account of every single fishing trip. And that helps me draw on information later. And then when I do like a special trip, like we typically hike, friends and I, in the summer in Montana and Idaho. We've done like a big trip through the Bitterroots wilderness hike. Then I take some really serious notes at night in the tent. And when I come home from that trip, I try to write something pretty quickly. I feel if I don't, I sometimes lose it. But if I can, you know, maybe you come back from a really special trip, and I really, while the iron is hot, I try to get something down, and I find it's more effective in actually getting a publishable essay together if I do that. I guess you're right. It is kind of like work a bit, but a good best work,
yeah.
You know?
It's good work. Yeah, for sure. What's your, your fishing log, do you have a journal that you kind of use out in the field, or is this more get back and write into a computer?
I get back and write. I do write by hand and then make digital copies so that they're not ever lost, but I do still write by hand, probably a generational thing.
Do you write by hand into like, what's the, you know, I'm trying to like, is it a notebook? Is it an actual leather bound journal?
I've tried leather bound, a little pretentious, right? The moleskin. No, it's a little bound kind of tablet, small tablet, maybe 5x7. And it's, you know, I've tried different kinds of journals. My wife bought me a beautiful fishing journal, but it has all these little categories like temperature and I feel very restricted. Like, well, maybe I don't want to talk about temperature right now, you know?
Yeah.
So I find that just the blank page allows me to creatively right now. I'm not a scientist, so I don't, you know, you can look up what the temperature was, I guess, maybe water temperature. Sometimes I'll record, but it's not a bunch of facts. I mean, it can be, but it's more, what I saw, how I felt, certainly what we caught or didn't catch, but it's not so much for my scientific, you know, research, like the old fishing logs, people like, you know, would study exactly what was hatching and the exact temperature. I'm more interested in kind of impressions of what happened. And then the dates are very useful. You know, the salmon season, I'm like, okay, here we are. It's October 15th. Last year we caught a nice Chinook. We better get out there.
Right. Yeah, that is true. Yeah, dates are good. Okay. And what about, you know, staying on, I guess, back to like editors, we talked about a few, Nick. I mean, are there, like when you think of editors, who are, you know, obviously you work with Craig. I mean, who are some of the great editors out there that come to your mind?
Yeah, Nick was one of the best in terms of acquiring books. You know, I think that magazine editors, that's a hard job. So Bill Sisson, I'm going to give him a shout for Angler's Journal. And I know he works with Gary. That is a really terrific editor. And I always like working with him. You know who's one of my favorite editors of all time? James Babb, the former editor of Grays. And Jim Babb is also a name worth mentioning. That man can write. So he had a book out a few years ago, and fly fishing, all the other kinds of fishing, but a brilliant writer. And he selected work for Gray's for years and also helped people, you know, rewrite. You know, sometimes editing is rewriting, and that's not bad. You know, there are different, some people are brilliant anglers and have a lot to say, but maybe aren't experienced as writers. And so I'll help some people out. You know, I'll just do a revision and track changes and send it back to them. And they're usually like, wow, thanks. You know, tighten a few things up. I know people do it to my writing, especially like Craig. Craig Schumann is a brilliant fly angler. And I'll write a short story with some fly fishing in it. And he'll be like, you know, Henry, I don't think that's really what would happen here. Yeah. Or, you know, yeah. No, you wouldn't be using that tippet on this. And so he cleans me up, you know, because he just has that higher level of knowledge, of technical knowledge. And I help him sometimes just with, you know, phrasing a metaphor or something. So we have a great complementary relationship, Craig Schumann and I. And that's the fun thing, working with a good writer, a fellow writer or an editor. You may have different skill sets or different areas of expertise, but you can really help each other. So you probably know some of the, who do you think, can I turn this on? Who do you think are some of the editors that you work with or fly fishing editors these days?
I think we've said some of them. I always think of, I think magazines come to mind first for me. And, you know, I mean, like you said, the Drake, that's always the one on top, you know, just, I don't know. I mean, the way that whole thing is so unique. It's interesting because writing and fly fishing and just trying to make a business in fly fishing is not easy because it's such a small niche. So right. You look at the ones that are successful, and the Drake has been one, you know. I mean, John Shuey, you know, I think, you know, he's probably another one that comes to my mind just because he's kind of local.
Yes.
But it seems like it's a struggle to me when I look at, especially the magazines, because we're seeing magazines go out of business, newspapers go out of business, you know, good magazines that are, you know, that are going away. And there's a few that have stuck around, right? You mentioned them, Gray's, Anglers.
Right.
You know, the Drake, the Fly Fisher. I mean, so why all these other ones are going out? Why do they stick around? I mean, is it the editor? Is it their style? Like, what's to keep, like for FTJ, what's to keep those, you guys from going away? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a tough question because beginning in the 1990s, media really changed. And of course, it's all about the internet and digital publishing and the way people get information. And so they just are more likely to look something up online than pick up a magazine. And so I think those magazines that survive are those that a couple things have to happen. They have to look good and adapt. And you know, there's a different aesthetic. You know, you can pick up a magazine from the 70s or from the 1950s and it has a feel. And we thought, oh, that looks cool. It's retro. But it feels like a magazine from the 50s, you know. And so you can be retro, but you can't be look, you know, totally outdated. And so magazines like Flyfish Journal and The Drake are beautiful, and they have a modern, fresh feel. Photography, digital photography has exploded. And you have to open that up and just say, wow, like, you know, these are gorgeous photos. I'm blown away by how beautiful this is. That's really important, that effect of a magazine, because it's competitive now. And then, you know, and not duplicating stuff that's online. That's why I do think the how-to, articles are going to fade away. Things do change. I mean, newspapers, you're right. People don't read print newspapers very much anymore. I work with the Statesman Journal here in Salem from time to time. I contribute to them. I know their sports, their fishing writer very well. And, you know, they struggle, but they have an online edition. And I subscribe to it because I think that's good, because I like having a newspaper in my state. But a lot of people, they just, you know, they get the three or 12 free visits and they don't subscribe. And but they're surviving. And I think that's what happens. You have to adapt or you won't survive. And so we're seeing far fewer. But I think the magazines, the fly fishing magazines that are alive today are good, are very good.
Yeah, that's right. Have you, you know, looking at your writing as things have evolved, and I'm not sure, it sounds like this has been a lifelong journey in writing, but how has your writing changed, evolved since we've been changing the different, the media has been changing the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, you know, they want shorter writing. A lot of magazines want shorter pieces. For example, I review books. I review books of poetry for Harvard Review. I've been doing it for years.
Oh, wow.
And you know, it's interesting. The editors now say, "Oh, Henry, can you get that review? It's 700 words." I used to write 1,200. So, but because it's online, they apparently, like, research shows that, you know, readers don't want to spend as much time. It sounds a little bit, you know, almost humorous, but I think people do have a shorter attention span. They seem to want to, you know, read shorter material. I mean, Field and Stream would be an obvious example. It's like, you know, it's like the USA Today or something of magazines. You know, I remember that as a kid. That was my favorite magazine, gorgeous magazine, nice articles. Talking to Ted Leeson about that. And he was like, "God, you know, they just want tiny little bits now, you know, and it's all flash."
Is it now, is that magazine kind of, I mean, do you read it? Is it good to read still? Or
I don't read it. You know, I found it like a doctor's office or something. I'll pick it up.
Yeah, that's what I see with the, well, I mean, this isn't everybody, but there's some websites you go to that you just go on. And I mean, literally you can't, it's hard to read. I mean, one of them, I mean, I guess, and they may have changed this, but like Fly Fisherman, right? I mean, they're a big, they've been around forever. They've right. got the magazine and stuff like that. But it seems like when I go on there, it seems like their website's flashing so much on right. advertisements and all this stuff. I can't even read it. I mean, I literally, every time I go there, I think I click away because, so I don't know, that's the struggle. How do you balance, obviously yeah. you got to make money, but I think that's the people that do it well. They've learned how to do the online stuff well, so it's not annoying.
Right. That's a really good point. And there is, you do learn to write for digital media. It can still be some good writing, and there is still some good writing out there. Fortunately, I don't have to write for a living. I am a teacher. And so I can just say, no, I don't really want to do that, and find places that still publish my longer pieces or still give me the space I need to stretch out in. And so I've been able to select, but I feel for young writers who want to make it, you know, in the commercial marketplace, they will have to adjust and look, study the magazines. I mean, study a magazine that you want to publish in. What kind of articles do they have? How long are they? I mean, it's all about word count, you know, and pitch something to that magazine. That's the biggest thing that we see at FTJ. I think every journal experiences people send in work that don't really know the magazine. And so it's not really appropriate for us, or it's not really in line with what we're doing. And you just kind of wasted your time. I mean, you have to really read the magazine, look at it, or look at the website and say, okay, I have something that seems to fit this. And that's really important when you're submitting.
Right. That's a great tip. Yeah. Something that, and maybe even, yeah, that, and then something that not only, it maybe makes it is different, right? It is something that they haven't, that it, you know, fits the magazine, exactly. but is also something unique.
Right. Cause that we'll get that too. You know, we'll get an article about, you know, whatever, Allegheny, you know, Brook Trout. And I'm like, well, we just ran, you know, a long article on that in the last issue. So it is good. And, you know, we all make mistakes. So we all, you know, miss our target. That's fine too. But yeah, just knowing the market a little bit and reading it really helps.
Well, I want to dig into, before we get out of here in a little bit on your, you know, some of the stuff we talked about already, some of the books and things like that. But I'm curious on the shows, right? So we're in this COVID, and are you teaching right now from, you pretty much just are at home, or are you going into class?
We're all on Zoom. And so we will resume face-to-face in the fall. That's our goal. But all okay. this year we have been teaching, remotely.
Gotcha. Remotely. And on the shows, I'm not sure. Do you go to any of the fly fishing shows, any of that stuff, the circuit or any of that stuff? Any of that stuff?
You know, I haven't, I think I would. I'm not really a big circus guy. but Craig Schumann has invited me, and I think I know Albany nearby has a nice show. And I think post COVID that I would go. I'm more involved with the magazine now and that kind of world. And so it'd be kind of fun to meet some of these personalities that we've been publishing or that I've been working with. But I'm not like, even I don't go to writers conferences anymore either. You know, there's big ones where you can meet a famous writer or hear these readings. I used to when I was younger, but I'm not as much into that aspect of whether it's the literary world or the fly fishing world, but I'm not opposed to them at all.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That, I mean, it makes sense. I think, you know, you find what you love, you know, what you enjoy doing. And, you know, I mean, I haven't gone to a ton of them either. I think I'll be going to more just as, for me, I've interviewed so many people. It'd be fun to make more connections in person.
Yeah. And you've got a kind of host personality. I think you'd be great at one of them. I mean, so you have had good experiences going to some of the shows?
Oh yeah. I love them. I mean, I always talk about, I've asked this question to a few and I could throw this back to you, but, you know, as far as the energy, you know, I think there's some people, you got two types of people. You got the people that, you know, you talk all day long, you're doing stuff with people. And at the end of the day, you're just burnt, you're spent, you're, you know, you're done. Or you got the people like me that I've learned that I'm the person that I could do this all day long. I could literally do these podcasts. I could do 12 of them today. And at the end of the day, I would still be just as energized.
Fascinating.
I mean, yeah. You know what I mean? And so I don't know. I think we're doing, where do you land more on? Which line do you on?
Well, obviously, it's great, and you have a real skill. You could be a teacher.
Oh, really? Is that what it takes to be a teacher?
Yes, because you have to give, you know, it's an emotional, you know, experience, and you have to kind of give of yourself a bit. Maybe there's more of the giving than the receiving, because when you're a host, you kind of ask questions, you can maybe sit back a bit. But yeah, I find it energizing. I find teaching energizing, but also exhausting if I have to, you know, keep the game going for 2 hours, you know, in a quiet class when you have to ask a lot of questions, which I like to do. But when you kind of have to really, you know, move them along.
Right. When you got classes that are sitting there and they're literally, you're asking questions and people aren't responding.
Sometimes, like a 100 level class, they're not majors. They're just taking it because they need that literature requirement.
Man, how do you get that? You know, I mean, it seems to me, I remember, right? Because I remember in college, and I actually struggled a little bit. You know what I mean? I found my groove after college. I was that quiet kid. You know what I mean? How do you connect with that quiet kid, or how does that work?
I really try. And, you know, it's a part of my job that I love. I don't always succeed at, but I really try to kind of, you know, be there, be very present, stand up, you know, speak, be animated, tell jokes, tell stories, read the passage, and make it interesting. I mean, that's my job, is to make, let's say it's a 100 level class, a literature class, we're doing a short story. You know, we're doing Hemingway's, right? Big Two-Hearted River. There we go. It's a fishing story. And I tell them some cool things about Hemingway. I tell them about World War I and emotional trauma and healing through fishing. And I can see sometimes a little flicker there, the lights going on. And that's just my job. And I try to reach them, but it's work. Sometimes it's work. And you do feel exhausted after the class, not in a bad way. It's like after a good workout, like a good run. But I definitely feel like, whoa, you know, that took some energy. But it's very rewarding. I actually enjoy that as much. Well, I enjoy it differently, but as much as even teaching an advanced class where they're really, you know, doing it, they're asking great questions and carrying the class. So,
and probably some of those classes you have, you know, people getting up to read, you know, passages and things like that. Is that, do you find that's a good engaging way to get people involved, or how does that look?
Yes. When people like to read, you know, it can make people very anxious if they don't like to read aloud, if they're not confident in their reading skills. And everyone makes mistakes reading. I do too. I tell them that. I said, I stumble over words or misread something. It's okay. But I say, would anyone like to read? And sometimes you'll have, you know, you have your go-to students who love to read and read well. And I do like when they read aloud, and I may be a little old fashioned that way. I think it's good to read aloud. I read my own work aloud because I can hear mistakes and I can make edits in some ways that I can't do internally in my brain. It's interesting how that happens, but I think it's good to hear work read aloud is wonderful. And so I try to encourage that, but I don't want to, you know, freak them out if they don't want to go there.
No. Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah, I love, you know, this is interesting for me because like I said, it was a big struggle for me. And I'm not sure if I even had maybe some sort of a learning disability or something, but I was, you know, I struggle with the reading. You know, that was definitely my worst nightmare, was getting in front of a class and reading. And the crazy thing is that after college, you know, it eventually came to me, and now, you know, I mean, you know, it's just like, I enjoy all of that, right? It's, so it clicked for me. I mean, obviously some people it clicks earlier. My daughter, she's 8 years old, and she's a better, she's probably a better reader than me. You know what I mean? So it's clicked for her way early.
Yeah.
So I think we're just all different. And I like what you said there. I mean, there's no reason to put extra pressure on somebody if they're not interested. It's just, you hate to lose the connection to a person that maybe, you know, if you don't make that connection, maybe you lose them as opposed to, they become, you know, who knows, right? Maybe they become a fly fisher and they do great things in conservation and everything.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of pressure is good. I think a little bit of pressure is good in life. I mean, we're in an age now where we're kind of, you know, there's this kind of accusation that we're coddling, you know, young people and students more than ever. And I'm okay with a little bit of pressure as long as, you know, it doesn't upset them. But you're right. We all develop differently. I was a very mediocre high school student. I mean, no one would have said, oh, that Henry Hughes, you know, he's going to go. I mean, I just was like fishing and daydreaming and like smoking pot and having a great time playing football. I loved high school. It was a great experience, but I was not a good student.
Were you more an athlete than an academic?
I was. I loved sports. I loved fishing and just, screwing around. And it wasn't until college where I actually got serious about, you know, writing and reading and so on. So, we all definitely hit it at different times. It's interesting.
What in college triggered you to take it on?
I had a really good teacher, a professor. I'm still friends with him, Joseph Ditta. And there was a kind of sincerity and an intensity that just like, wow, I really like this. And I went to a very small college. I went on a football scholarship and in South Dakota. And
oh, wow.
I basically got my ass kicked in football.
Yeah, which is not, South Dakota is, I look at our numbers as far as listeners to the podcast, that's not a hot spot for fly fishing.
I got this little scholarship and here I am at this little school and I'm playing football and I'm trying to, and I was like, you know what, Henry, you're not going to be a football player.
No.
You better be a student. And I did kind of fall in love. I was a biology and English major, and I loved learning about nature. And I really did. I really got into my studies. I enjoyed suddenly like reading and writing more. I mean, I always read, but not like this. And then I worked on our local newspaper, and I had a little show with a friend. We did like a little radio show. So, and I did fish. I fished the Missouri River. Now that there are big brown trout in the Missouri. And of course the famous fish of South Dakota, walleye, pike.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Not really fly fish targets, but we could catch them. But we caught some big brown trout near Pierre, which is the capital of South Dakota. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, okay. So there's a little bit of fish in there. Yeah, we have, no, I know, like I said, it's not a hot spot, but we definitely have some listeners out in that area. And
that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Indiana, I went to graduate school at Purdue on the Wabash River.
Oh, yeah.
And fished a lot. And that's where I met Willard Greenwood, who is one of our contributors at FTJ. Willard is a great fly fisherman and writer. And I always fly fished a bit, but he was like, no, we got to do this. We would go to these dams and stuff and catch smallmouth bass and wipers, like hybrid white striped bass. And and we fished for a lot of smallmouth there on the Tippecanoe River and tributaries to the Wabash. And then I did a lot of bait. I like bait and gear too. We'd catch giant catfish. We caught like a 40-pound catfish once. Jeez. Out of the Wabash.
Nice.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh, man. Well, I think, I want to just touch before we get out of here. We mentioned Craig a few times, and Craig's a great guy. I'm just curious. I'm not sure if we've touched on this, but how did you connect with Craig for the first time? How'd that come to be?
Yeah, Craig heard about my book, Backseat with Fish. I think the publisher sent copies to the major magazines, and Craig contacted me and asked if he could print, which is typical. You have a new book come out, they do a reprint. He wanted to use a section where I describe, I think that was a fly fishing section on the Connecticut River on Long Island, where I grew up. It's a beautiful old fishing like preserve that they've restored. So he liked the piece and wanted to use it. And he said, well, if you want to contribute some more things. And so we just kind of connected. And I really like Craig. He's, you know, he's very, as you say, sincere and funny and knowledgeable. And we just clicked. And so I started, I contributed a few pieces for them and then started helping with editing. Again, I do more of the literary, like the essay and the poems and some of the travel pieces, But I did a one of my, you know, I did an interview with Tom McGuain a few years ago that we published. That was a lot of fun. And so things like that, you know, even getting some students. I've mentored some students who have contributed articles to the magazine, which has been very satisfying.
Oh, wow. How was the talk about that interview with Tom McGuain? Because that's, again, going back to GearRock, like we talked at the start. When I interviewed him, he talked about how, yeah, because obviously as an author, you do some interviews but he said he wasn't a great interview. And there's the Terry Grosses of the world and the people that know how to to get, you know what I mean? How was that for you? How'd that go?
Oh, McGuain is an absolute gentleman. He's wonderful. My wife and I were camping in Boulder Creek in Montana, and you know, we were like, we weren't even showered. We kind of like, you know, fixed our hair as best we could, and we drove up to his ranch, and he came down to the gate to meet us and gave us a big hug. This is about 2 years ago. And we just sat, and Lori, you know, came out, and his wife, and brought us iced teas, and we just talked. All these dogs, he's got like six dogs, they're all like breathing on us, and you know, their tongues are dripping on my microphone, and we had a good laugh. No, he's really warm, funny, of course, tremendous experiences. We talked about, you know, all the wonderful people in his world too, you know, fishing with Jim Harrison, you know, and of course, Chouinard and, Valden, you know, some of the characters, the Fat Boys, the old Key West crowd, and so he's lived, as you know, some of the greatest fly fishing history of the 20th century. And then he's just, you know, he's sensitive to culture, and he's, you know, he lives in a very conservative area, and he's kind of a liberal, and, you know, and so but he makes peace. You know, he's also, they respect him. You know, he can ride a horse and shoot a gun. And so I'm kind of like that, you know. I mean, I like the outdoors, and I like, you know, shooting and fishing, and but I don't like some of the politics associated with that. So, I mean, McGuain can just talk frankly and warmly and hopefully about a kind of America where that sporting life integrates nicely with a kind of, you know, sensitivity too to where we should be. He's a good conservationist, loves his fish. And they're like his pets. You know, he fishes right there on his creek. And
where's he at? What state is he in?
Yeah, it's Montana. It's Sweetgrass County. It's on the, I can't reveal his address.
Yeah, no, sure,
it's,
sure.
It's the big, he lives right on a nice creek. And, you know, he took us to his writing studio, and so gracious to my wife too. And, you know, and.
What's his writing studio look like?
Oh, beautiful, like kind of log cabin.
Oh, wow.
Fly rod right over the threshold. He can just grab it and head down to the creek.
He's but, right there.
Yeah, he's got a nice fly tying desk.
What was this? This was for, is this out somewhere? Or were you doing this for another piece?
This was for a fly fishing and tying journal.
Oh, and is there this interview's in the journal?
Yeah, it's in the journal. Yeah.
Okay. How do you find, is there a way to find like this one or past, you know, like online? So for somebody that maybe missed the magazine or doesn't have a subscription, how could they find that and read it?
That's one of our weaknesses. We do not have a nice online.
Once it's out, it's gone for now.
Yeah, a few articles are posted, and we're trying to urge, you know, Tony Amato to do more of that. Because you're right, that's like if you look at a great magazine, for example, Tail, a wonderful saltwater fly fishing magazine, every issue is available online, like the whole issue. It's exactly. Beautiful. It looks great.
Well, and it makes sense because for both, right? Yeah, it makes sense for that. For the, I mean, I feel like for me, you know, reading it is one thing. And having the magazine physical copy is people love too. So I think you can have both. I think that's probably what Tail's finding is that why not put it out there? It's content marketing and people can read it and they can read old episodes, right?
Exactly. I mean, it was a question for them. George Roberts, who's their acquisitions editor, is a good friend of mine. And they did, you know, go over that, like, are we giving away our product for free? Well, you know, not really. And, you know, it's there. Maybe it's a little bit later than the print issue. Or you could do what Gray's does. The selected pieces are available online, but not the whole thing. And where FTJ is kind of moving to that, but you're right. I mean, all the magazines are archived. For example, many libraries have every issue, and there's a potential for going back and digitalizing those. That's work. Mm-hmm. You should do it, you know, when you've got your files at hand. But you're right. That archiving is a big problem. I'd like to see more. Access. I'm a big proponent for access to to material, digital material. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And access being like free access.
Free access. Yes. I believe in that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I do too. I think that's the podcasting, you know, is the beauty. There's ways to make, you know, to make money there. But I think the podcasting is cool because it's just, it's all free. I mean, we actually are right in the middle now of going to, there's a lot of these paid services going out there where people are making premium content and trying to, you know, putting up paywalls. But, you know, I think some of that is good, but I think really the majority of just having it free out there is the best way, because I think people will pay you back once they get to know you and learn your stuff.
I think so too. And I appreciate that you're doing that. That's really great, Dave.
Yeah. Well, before we get out, just talk about your, I mean, we mentioned one book. I know you've written a lot with the magazines, but are there other books you want to highlight here before we get out of here?
Well, I have Backseat with Fish, which is coming out in paperback next month. And then I did two anthologies that may interest readers. They're beautifully printed through the Knopf Random House publisher. And that is The Art of Angling, Poems About Fishing, and Fishing Stories. So I'm the editor. I compiled them, but I wrote introductions. And they're really lovely, lovely books. I'm also a poet, and I've published 4 books of poetry. And so those are available too through Amazon. My last book was called Bunch of Animals. And there's always a few fishing poems sprinkled in there. But yeah, I'm kind of writing for magazines now mostly, and doing book reviews and other projects. But probably in the next year or so, I should start putting together another book. I've been writing a lot of short fiction as well, Dave, and I enjoy writing short stories. In fact, I have a story out in the current issue of Grays called Boron, and those wonderful boron rods are featured in the story. But so that's another thing I'm really enjoying, is writing short stories, and I've had one in FTJ and Harvard Review, and so hopefully maybe you'll see more of that.
Nice, nice. All right. Well, I'll put links to all that in the show notes. And one random one here before we get out. I've been doing a little bit of a music thing. This has been ongoing. I've been enjoying it because I've been asking, okay, what's your favorite music, you know, band or type of music? And now I figured out with Spotify, which our podcast is on Spotify, but you can create some channels. So I'm doing a guest Spotify channel at wetflyswing.com/music. So you can go on there and actually listen to what it's a compilation of all of our guests.
Wonderful.
What they've said. So for you, do you have anything that comes to mind? Like, do you listen to music?
Oh, I love listening to music. And my son is a musician at Portland State. So,
oh, nice.
We talk about music a lot. You know, I've got some bands that Grateful Dead. I'm a big Grateful Dead fan. Scarlet Begonias, one of my favorite songs. I mean, China Cat, Sunflower, a lot of the Dead. I love Neil Young, big Neil Young fan, Rolling Stones. So classic rock is probably my thing. Although, you know, I listen to new music too. Pearl Jam, Nirvana, that's 90s. God, I'm dating myself.
But, yep. Oh yeah.
So yeah, I guess, you know, rock and roll, baby.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'll add it to our mix, our Spotify mix. I'll add the Grateful Dead. I don't have the Grateful Dead yet. So it'll be interesting to see how this turns out, because I'm just starting it. But once we mix in all of our guests, the music into one compilation, it's going to be pretty interesting.
That's a really great idea. Absolutely. See, I love the way you're integrating all the arts. This is beautiful.
That's right. It is art. Yeah, yeah. No, it is. Well, it comes to me. I live off of my guests. You know, I think that idea, I can't remember where it came. One of my guests mentioned that they had the Spotify thing going, and I just was like, okay, yeah, this makes sense.
What's one of your favorite bands?
Well, you said it. I mean, I definitely love the Dead, the Stones, Zeppelin. Probably one of those three. I mean, I'm more class. And I also do love the old country, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard.
Me too.
Willie Nelson. Yeah. Yeah, so it's probably tied between those two. Between, like, if I had to put Zeppelin up with Johnny Cash, that'd be a tough one for me.
Yeah, for me too. I love storytelling, you know, and they both are, and just about the guitar, Zeppelin's guitar, man. Oh my God.
Yeah, the Zeppelin's good. Well, and the cool thing is yeah, it is stories, but it's also, there's a connection to the, both that Johnny Cash and Zeppelin to like the blues, right? There's a good blues connection.
Absolutely.
So,
beautiful.
All right, Henry. Well, hey, in the next, say, 6 months or so, anything new you want to give a shout out? Any other books or magazine articles you have coming out?
Well, just look for me in Angler's Journal. And as I said, I've got a story coming out in Grays. And I really appreciate what you're doing, Dave Stewart. It's a great podcast. And let's just keep fly fishing and keep the planet as healthy as we can. And we'll see you around the next bend of the river.
All right. Sounds good. I'll try to keep it going my best. And we'll send people out to HughesPoetry.com as well.
Thank you.
All right. See you, Henry.
Thanks very much. Take care.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links and everything else we covered today, just head over to wetflyswing.com/231. That's 231. If you've been enjoying the show in the past or today, head over to wetflyswing.com/review or just click the review button, a rating and review button in your app of choice, and leave us a quick review. This helps get the word out there and lets people know that you're enjoying the show, and it's just real helpful. I read every one of the reviews, so I always love checking those out. Thanks in advance if you've had a chance to do that. Tune in next Tuesday morning when Ed Jaworowski is here to share his new book on flight casting. This is a killer book, and he takes us through the step-by-step to improving your casting this season. I'm looking forward to catching up with you soon. Thanks again for stopping by today and listening to the show all the way till the end here. I appreciate your support and appreciate you. So please stay in touch and let's talk soon. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.